Okay. Good evening. Thanks everyone for coming. Just trying to figure out what might be good to talk about the next couple of weeks. And I thought talking about stuff related to Shul in general is a good topic, but especially coming out of Tisha B'Av makes it an auspicious time to talk about how we've accommodated ourselves post the Chorban up until this day. So what I want to discuss today is in general, just the comparison between Beis HaMikdash and Shuls, if there is a comparison, if there is, to what extent. So we'll explore a little bit, and we'll see that in some ways Shuls have a role in, I don't want to say replacing the Beis HaMikdash, but in modestly taking their place. Some push that comparison pretty far, and others not as much. So, first of all, the whole idea of having a place of Mikdash originates with the Mishkan. Vasulu Mikdash v'shachanti v'socham. Hashem says before the making of the Mishkan that there should be a sanctuary that may dwell upon them. Rashi explains that Asu Lishmi Bais Kedusha, so the idea of making a Mikdash is not abstract, but there's an idea of making a physical space that is meant to be a place for holiness and for the Shechina. The idea, of course, then we have the Mishkan based on Mikdash, but fast forward a few hundred years, so the idea of having a shul that's not a Beis HaMikdash is found in Yechezkel. Yechezkel says that at the point where the Jews are far from Eretz Yisrael, that I will be for them a little sanctuary, for lack of a better term, in the countries where they have gone. So that seems to be the first mention of any idea of sort of a temporary or smaller sort of Mikdash. And Rashi and the Mitzvot Stavi both explain that this refers to shuls. It's not Mikdash Ma'at. Again, it's not an abstract concept, or it's not necessarily another way to interpret that other than as Rashi says, Abati Knishka, that we sit in, or as Mitzvot Stavi says, that that beyond the fact that it's based Knesset, but the idea that the actual Shechina is still to be found in shuls when we're distanced from Yerushalayim. Okay, so Yechezkel gives us a precedent for having something like a shul where we could connect with God even post the Beis HaMikdash. And the Or HaChaim again accentuates that not only is an opportunity to connect with God in Galus, but it's even Tzrichin HaYisrael Lasos Kein Afil B'Galiot, that Bnei Yisrael were required to do this even in exile. He actually comments that when it comes to in the Pasuk in Shmot, that when it says Vasul Mikdash Veshachani B'tocham, that's not just talking about the Mishkan, but even in exile, we should have a Beis HaMikdash. Fine. So, just for a little bit of historical background, I pulled from the Encyclopedia Judaica, where they basically comment that the notion of a synagogue really appears in the Babylonian exile, as Yechezkel notes. And they say specifically that's in Yechezkel that we first really find the concept of a shul, the reference to Beis HaMikdash. They note that there's no mention of a shul in Ezra and Nehemiah, but they argue that it can be assumed that that there was a concept of a shul. That there was a concept of a shul that was brought from Bavel back to Eretz Yisrael. But they say that it was really in the first century CE that that shul become a big part, and they note that the idea that that shul, for that matter, tefillah, only came about after the destruction of Beis HaMikdash, particularly during, let's say, I mean, maybe after the first Beis HaMikdash, that was true, but when it comes to the second Beis HaMikdash, so shuls and tefillah outside korbanos and the Beis HaMikdash did exist concurrently with the Beis HaMikdash, so Beis HaMikdash was obviously central, but that didn't negate the fact that there seemed to be synagogues and there seemed to be davening, so they seemed to sort of coexist. This is the part where I want to really emphasize here. Many of the customs, this is in the italics in source 4, many of the customs and rituals of the temple were deliberately and consciously transferred to the synagogue, and on the other hand, some of these rituals were forbidden just for the reason that they belonged to the temple and the temple only. That's actually kind of an important tension here, that We have some nice new chairs that nobody seems to have known about.
Nobody knows.
Doug, did you know?
It's a mystery.
Yes, I know.
Doug knew. Okay, that's good.
You can't tell us, Doug. It's a secret.
If he tells us, he has to kill us.
Wait, that's, that'd be
what a way to go. I'm ready.
Tishba was just last week. So there's a tension here because on the one hand, intuitively, we might think that if we want to look for a model of what Ishul should look like, so we might look to the Beis HaMikdash. But on the other hand, as they note here, there might be a problem and a tension in doing so because if the Beis HaMikdash is supposed to be something special, so maybe that doesn't fully apply to Ishul, both on principle, but also perhaps as a matter of practice. Up to source 5 now, for those who just arrived.
You said that some things were left in the temple and some things were. Was there a reason to how they decided the space?
So we'll see a couple of examples of that, but I think I don't know for each particular thing if there is a rhyme or reason. We could try to come up with examples, but the conceptual point that I was trying to get at was that it could be, on the one hand, you want if we call it a mikdash ma'al, which means that it's meant to resemble something of a Beis HaMikdash, and that makes sense if we want to maintain a connection with the Shekhinah, that model definitely makes sense, but at the same time, the shul is definitely, it's only mikdash ma'al, it's only a model of the Beis HaMikdash, but you can't entirely transpose one onto the other. And then with the Gemara in source 5, just wanted
doesn't
to...
doesn't give examples of what's not permitted. That was permitted in the basement.
So, we'll have some. So I just want to accentuate that the Gemara itself also picks up that Vahila HaMikdash Ma'at. So these are shuls and Batei Midrash. Okay, so this leads up to the point. So to what extent is this comparison possible between Beis HaMikdash and Mikdash Ma'at? A lot of these sources I got from Rabbi Jonathan Ziering when I was thinking of doing the Shiur. I found actually on Why Your Torah that he had given a shiur pretty much on this topic. So a lot of these sources I got from him, they're very useful. Okay, so let's start with this. Source 6, the Gemara Megillah tells us that that shuls in Bavel atznai hein asud, and they're done on with a stipulation, meaning that in theory, if you build a shul, you build something that's meant to have kedusha. So you probably should have a very strict protocol for what it's used for and the way it can be used and what can be done with it, perhaps after it falls into disuse. But with shul, so they were done under stipulation that they could be used for other purposes. But Alpha P came, nonetheless, Eino Agin Mahan Kalos Rosh. So one thing that's going to come up a few times is this idea of Kalos Rosh, of acting properly with the proper mindset and without frivolity, both in shuls and the Beis HaMikdash. So already here, so we can see that, Batei Knesiot, so on the one hand, we might have the suggestion that they're not like the Beis HaMikdash because they're done al tanai, they're done with some sort of stipulation that that they are not necessarily permanent and have the same kedusha that you would have in Beis HaMikdash. But on the other hand, we see that Kalos Rosh is not permitted, so that already is giving us an example of somewhere where they are comparable. So, if we look at the Gemara and the Mishnah in Brachot, source 7, so we learn, this is specifically about the Beit HaMikdash, but we're going to have to make some comparisons after that. So, a person should not be frivolous when they're standing by the gates opposite the Kodesh Kodashim. Lo yikanes lahar habayis b'makel minalo ubefundaso uveavak shal raglav. So a person should make sure that they don't enter the Azara or the Har Habayit with their shoes on, not with a wallet, not with dusty feet, not with their staff. Velo yasan kapendaria, shouldn't make it a shortcut. And spitting is all the more so forbidden. So we already saw that the notion of Kalos Rosh seems to be borrowed two shuls from Beis HaMikdash, that we're not allowed to have Kalos Rosh in a shul. But some of these other examples, We'll have to see whether they apply. But the Malam Beis HaMikdash is all those things degrade the honor and the reverence that one should have for the place, right? So coming in with dusty feet, so that's should come into a holy place clean. That intuitively makes sense. The idea of not using it as a compendiary, not making it a shortcut, that it's not just a convenient way to go through, but it's something that special stands out and is separate. But I'm just saying, in terms of Beis HaMikdash, this is what explains it. So what do we do with the shul? So the Gemara in Brachos comments that anybody who spits, this is source A, call a roll kick by Har HaBayis b'zman hazeh. Anybody who spits on Har HaBayis, again, we're talking Beis HaMikdash during this time, meaning in the time of exile, ki ilu roll cake bevas eno shenemar vayu enai v'libi sham kol harami. So spitting,
we'll get there.
Right, but if you spit on Har HaBayis, so it's spitting in God's pupil. So now, then Rabbah comes and says, as Lenny said, kika bevas knesses sharya. You're allowed to spit in the shul. Midi to have a amino. It's like shoes. So ma amino behar abayis aser vesa knesses mutter. Afer kika behar abayis uda aser vesa knesses shari. So we're saying basically. So first of all, we again just to emphasize, kalos rosh is not allowed in shul, just like it's not on Beis HaMikdash. We said that spitting on har abayis, even during this time when it's destroyed, is still a slap in the face to God. But what about in shul? So Rava says that spitting in shul is permitted, just like wearing shoes is permitted. Okay, so, and we're not allowed to wear shoes on Har HaBayis, but we're allowed to wear in shuls. So we there learn from that just like we're allowed to wear shoes in shul, so therefore we're allowed to spit in shul, right? So this already seems to show a little bit of a disconnect between what was allowed in Beis HaMikdash and the way we treat the Beis HaMikdash and what was allowed in shul. So then the Gemara says, well, maybe, why don't we say that we shouldn't be allowed to spit in shul, just like we're not allowed to use shul as a commandaria. So that also, the Gemara seems to be assuming, just like you're not allowed to take a shortcut through the Beis HaMikdash, you're also not allowed to take a shortcut through shul. When I was working at SAR last year, they were doing some construction in the school, and they were making more classrooms, so some classes were meeting in a room that was either accessible through going through the main office or going through the base medrash. So what ended up happening was that the easiest way for people to get through was to go through the base medrash. So at a certain point, the administration and some of the rebbeim tried to make a point to tell the students to learn halacha as they're walking through the base medrash, which avoids the kabbadaria problem. But okay, so the point is that kabbadaria is not allowed in shul or the base hamikdash, so why don't we say spitting is also not allowed and the Beis HaMikdash, right? Why are we saying that it's allowed just because shoes are allowed? Maybe a kampadari is a better model. So Rava says, well, because there's different factors here. The factor here should be one's home. Ma beso a kampadari or kapi inish. So generally speaking, it's not polite to go through someone's house or even their backyard without asking their permission, right? Even if it's a shortcut. So just like when it comes to one's own home, so one wouldn't use it as a shortcut. So spitting and shoes, so people care a little less if you do that in their homes. But therefore, kabbadaria is forbidden in shuls because you would treat your home in the same way. But spitting and wearing shoes is okay in a shul since you'd be okay doing that in your home.
I don't think so.
we'll come to exceptions of both of these, but the Gemara's framework right now seems to be that in some ways, actually, if anything, shul is not necessarily comparable to Beis HaMikdash, but we're also comparing it to our own homes, which are, on the one hand, we want our homes to be places of Kedusha, but definitely our homes are not the Beis HaMikdash. Okay, so all I'm trying to do right now is sort of set up this tension between treating shuls like a Beis HaMikdash versus not. Okay, so we'll see some arguments in both ways. We seem to have hints in the Gemara itself, even to what extent the comparison flies. Okay, so up to this point, questions, clarifying or otherwise. All right, so let's go right here. Keep an eye on the clock. 7:16. All right, so let's see some examples of how Shul and Beis HaMikdash are similar but different. So Tosfot tell, so we saw before in the Gemara that the shuls in Bavel were made on a condition, on a stipulation, with a stipulation that they could be used for other purposes. And Tosfos in Source 9 explains that the distinction is Davka losan shebavel mehani atznai shared la isba gobim herbi amin. So in Bavel you could use shuls as a you could maybe use them for other purpose. They have a lesser kedusha because one day Mashiach's going to come. We're not going to need the shuls in Bavel, and for that matter, all the Chotza Aretz. So they're not going to be anything anymore. So you know the kedusha is not permanent and is somewhat somewhat subjective. But those in Eretz Yisrael, so the shuls in Eretz Yisrael are always going to be used as shul. So therefore, their kedusha is permanent. So here Tosfos seems to give us a sense that fundamentally, a shul is not necessarily the same as a Beis HaMikdash. In Eretz Yisrael, maybe a little more so. It might have to do with the permanence of the place, or at least the intention of permanence. But in Chutz Ha'aretz, where there's no intention that shuls are permanent, right? So, you know, we have a nice shul. There are plenty of shuls. I know of a shul today that's during capital campaign, and they're raising a lot of money, and they're going to make them very nice. And at the same time, you know, we have that tension of, well, maybe this is only temporary because hopefully we won't we'll need these anymore. Turn to the page, source 10. I'm not going to do this one inside, but the Ran and the Ramban both agree that shuls have a lesser kedusha than that of the Beis HaMikdash, but out of different conceptions. So first, the Ran brings the Ramban and talking about the possibility of selling a shul. So the Ramban says, well, how could you sell a shul if it's a place of kedusha? So what makes you think that the kedusha can just be suspended with? How do you know it's dispensable? So the Ramban makes a comparison to a sukkah and a lulav, and we have other mitzvahs where this is relevant, where when you use a sukkah or a lulav, so you have to treat it a certain level of respect. Can't dispose of it while, or you can't use it for not its purpose while it's being used. But once it passes, so then its kedusha is done away with. There still might be a proper way to treat it, but fundamentally, once sukkah is over, so lulav, especially it's gonna wither out at some point. So that's it. Lulav's done with, and it doesn't have the same kedusha anymore. So Ramban suggests that maybe a shul is like that. That while a shul is being used or has a possibility of being used, even if it's partially destroyed or in disuse, but there's a chance that it might be renovated or rebuilt. So then the shul will still have its kedusha because it's intended for that purpose. But once it's very clear that the shul is not going to have kedusha anymore, so then that's where it's kind of like a sukkah and a lulav, where it might be able to get around that kedusha. The Ran disagrees because this is sort of the way the Ramban sets it up sort of assumes that the reason why we can't that lulav and sukkah maintain their kedusha is because you're not allowed to disgrace a mitzvah, so you know you can't use a sukkah for any sort of unfit purpose because it's a disgrace to the mitzvah while you're doing it. But that doesn't seem to make sense with the shul, because once it's not being used anymore, and especially if you're going to sell it, let's say, so the shul's not being used anymore, and the money has no, there's no disgrace per se that happens with the money when the money becomes, a sort of hektish for that purpose. So the Ran's point is basically that instead what we have to say is that the sages decreed that because shuls are used for holy purpose, we say dvarim should be kedusha, so that one makes a shul kadosh. That's what makes it holy. So there's nothing inherent about the shul itself that's holy, but it's just that the sages enacted that anything that's used as a shul has kedusha. But either way, both the Ramban and the Ran seem to say that there's a lesser status of kedusha than the Beis HaMikdash for sure, right? That the kedusha is not everlasting.
The shul is not used. It's selling the shul.
Selling the shul, or it's abandoned, or you know,
there's no kedusha at all. But we always know that, like tzitzis or whatever, you shouldn't just be bizoying on it. You shouldn't once it's used for a mission.
Right, again, that's where the Ramban saying is like sukkah and lulav. That doesn't mean that you can't totally use it in a disgraceful way, but it doesn't have... But
once you sell it, who knows what they're going to use it for?
Well, the point is, but we are allowed to sell shuls in the, we're in Paskin. So why are we allowed to sell? So, I guess once it's sold and it's not used for that purpose, so I mean, might be a good idea for the Jews before to
not sell it.
Well, to not sell. I'm saying to make sure that everything that has some sentimental value is dealt with properly, and it's really just the building that's left. But yeah, but the point is that. The show's not quite the same as a base subject dash according to this conceptual framework, right? And Rav Soloveitchik has seems to go along a similar path in saying that a base hamikdash is different than a shul, because a base hamikdash, so we have a mitzvah to revere a base hamikdash, that you should have reverence, you should have awe for my holy places. Beis HaKnesses, so you only have to, it only has an aspect of kavod, right?
Kavod.
Respect. So that's, kavod and yira might be similar things. There's still an element of respect and reverence, but kavod is probably a lesser level of respect. You don't have the same kind of, don't have the same level of the emotional attachment to it is certainly different. And, when it comes to a shul, so that might be why, for example, we might be lenient about wearing your shoes and shul, because on Harabite, so you have to have a certain amount of reverence. When Moshe was at the burning bush, he had to take off his shoes. Okay, so it seems like with holiness, when you're standing in front of God, so a way that we express our reverence is by taking off our shoes. But if the shul is merely a place of kavod, so then. It just depends on what's a proper way to treat a place, but it's not necessarily an objective level of reference and not as high a level of reverence. So the Rav also seems to go through this route that there's something greater about a Beis HaMikdash than a shul. Again, it seems like there are comparisons that are going to be made, but conceptually speaking, they're very different places. With that said, there are places where there seem to be a strong conceptual link between the Beis HaMikdash and the shul. So, for example in source 12, I brought from the Rambam's enumeration of the mitzvot that the when it comes to the negative mitzvot and the 65th one is that you're not allowed to destroy the Beis HaMikdash and shuls and batei medrash. So, according to, and that's based on a pasuk that we'll read in a couple of weeks, that you're supposed to get rid of the idolatrous places of worship. And then it says, "Lo tashu kein l'Hashem elokecha, elokeichem." You shouldn't do this to Hashem, which makes it seem like that from that. So you're not allowed to destroy certainly Beis HaMikdash. And the Rambam also says that's true about shul. Again, I don't know if everybody would agree with the way he formulated it, but the Rambam seems to make in the same breath he says that he seems to equate the kedusha of a shul and Beis HaMikdash. The Reim also says that you're not allowed to, this is source 13, that you're not allowed to have hana, you're not allowed to benefit from a shul. And I assume what we mean here is that, let's just say, just to use a very basic example, like if there was a brick in the shul and you wanted to chisel it out and use it for another building or whatever. So, right, so you couldn't do that. Right? You're not allowed to get hana from, because it's a holy place. So he seems to equate that with the Beis HaMikdash, right? There's hekdesh in the Beis HaMikdash, so you're also not allowed to do that for places that are specifically designated for prayer and tefillah. Okay, so I'm going to skip the next Rambam, but there he sort of elaborates on the concept of Yira in the Beis HaMikdash. So again, going looking at the Rav in source 15, so he explains the difference between the Ramban and the Ran on the one hand and the Rambam on the other hand, that the Ran and the Ramban both seem to think that the sanctity of a shul is basically Darabana, and it's more rabbinic in decree. For Ramban, it's more about the actual object, right? That's why he compares it to Lulav and Sukkah, where the object itself. For the Ran, it's more of the atmosphere of what a shul provides, but either way, they both think it's rabbinic, and the Rav hammers the point away that the Rambam seems to hold that a shul is is kadosh through a deoraita, that it's just as biblically sanctified and holy as a Beit HaMikdash. Okay, so basic point up to this point is that we have different conceptual ways of seeing whether a shul is like Beit HaMikdash or not, and according to some, you know, shul really is very much meant to mimic the Beit HaMikdash in more ways than not, and we're always supposed to treat it with the same way. For others, it's a model, but it's not quite the same. It doesn't have the same level of holiness. Just another point in this vein. So the Shulchan Aruch says that when it comes to shuls and Bate Medrash, you're not allowed to have frivolity, you're not allowed to have Kalos Rosh. Okay, so this we saw was true in the Beis HaMikdash, and this is certainly certainly true in Shul. And they list other things. This is also found in the Gemara that about not eating and drinking them, you shouldn't use a shul as a place to find shelter when it's raining or when it's hot outside. It's not meant to be used for that sort of pedestrian purpose, but it has a level of holiness. So just to bring it first full circle. So I had suggested before that the Gemara where it said that you shouldn't have Kalos Rosh in the shul makes it seem like that it's like the Beis HaMikdash. The Mishnah Berurah in Source 17 really says that explicitly. So he brings it full circle in saying that the reason why you're not allowed Kalos Rosh specifically in a shul is because it's a Mikdash Me'at, based on the verse, Vehi Lahem LaMikdash Me'at. So the Mishnah Berurah is the one that says the reason why you can't have Kalos Rosh in a shul is because a shul is like a Beis HaMikdash. And if you're not allowed frivolously in the Beis HaMikdash, then you're definitely not allowed to do it in the shul either. Okay, so he brings that full circle and making that direct comparison between what's proper in shul and what's proper in the Beis HaMikdash. So let's get into some practical applications. And some of these have been mentioned in passing so far, but we'll explore them with greater depth. So, for example, shoes, right? We take for granted that we come to shul and we keep our shoes on, and that seems acceptable. Maybe in Tisha B'Av and Yom Kippur, we might change or take them off. But barring that, we wear shoes in shul. We seem to take that for granted, but there seem to have been a fixation about not wearing shoes, certainly in the Beis HaMikdash, but the Gemara even suggested that shoes were okay in shul. So the Rashbash, Rabbi Shlomo ben Shimon Duran, his father was a Tashbetz, and they were in North Africa. So he was asked a question. It sounds like a question that if you change a few words could happen in any shul. So the shul wanted to enact a rule that nobody's allowed to wear shoes in shul. The reason why they wanted to do that was because they were in an Arab society. They were in an Arab society, so if the Muslims were wearing shoes, then we certainly shouldn't do it because they'll disparage our places of worship. And there's another shul where they have that rule anyway also, right? So we should be like everybody else. And if they don't have shoes, we don't have shoes either. And some people are saying, I should be able to wear my shoes in shul because it's allowed. The Rambam says it, and the Gemara even seems to say it. So how do we get this discrepancy? So the Rashbash says, well, and this seems to go very well with the idea of the Rav, that the idea of a shul is that we treat it with kavod. So if we're talking about kavod, then kavod is subjective. In a place where it would be okay to wear shoes in a place of worship, or if you're going to the palace to meet the king or the sultan, or the like, and you would wear your shoes, so then that would be okay. So in Christian societies where people where they wear their shoes in church, so maybe that would be okay. But here,
take off the hat too.
What?
Then take off the hat too. Do I have to follow them to take off my hat?
You don't wear a hat, Lenny.
Yeah, but would you go in front of a king with a hat?
That's a fair question. But here in a Muslim society, where it's considered degrading, it's not just that it's not dumb, but it's degrading to wear shoes in a holy place, so then it would be objectively not allowed. So the Rashbash's point is that when we think about the way we treat the way we treat a shul. So it might very much depend on the norms of society and what makes sense. It happens to be that shoes gets mentioned already, already in the Gemara and other sources, but even the further application of that really might depend on societal norms.
But we don't wear shoes when we duffin.
Right, the so maybe that maybe like goes
yeah,
back
I
to
think
the,
they the time to make that
right.
Explicit.
Right, right. Okay, so that's a we'll get to a duchni example in a minute. I'm just gonna skip to source.
The main time you don't wear shoes is when we're in Avelos, and not wearing shoes is when you're sitting shiva. You don't wear shoes.
Right.
So you don't want to say okay, we won't wear shoes because it's kado.
Right, but maybe it has something to do with there's some. Well, I guess it's almost the opposite.
Not
that,
wearing
right.
the shoes is because of comfort.
Right, right. Well, so yeah, there has to do with comfort, but it also could be that, I mean, not wearing shoes during Shiva, Davka seems to be a way of avoiding kavod, and wearing shoes in shul might, or not, you know, not wearing shoes in shul might be a way of kavod, depending where you are, but so it might not be a perfect comparison in that sense. So Rav Schechter, in source 20, quotes the Rav, who said that, brought up the issue when it comes to boots. Okay, so if it's winter, and working outside and snowing, so you're going to wear boots. But then what do you do when you get to shul? Because would you walk into the White House wearing boots and getting the whole shul all slushy and the like? So the Rav said that, you know, if you're wearing apparently something called goloshes, or those are the covers for boots. So right,
you're showing your age.
Galoshes, right? So those are definitely not allowed in shul. You have to take them off when you get there. And even wearing boots in general, so the Rav said you should publicize that this is very problematic, because shoes is one thing, but wearing boots, which are really meant to, you know, those we only wear in the snow, so that brings a little, it is a little bit degrading. If you go into someone's house, they actually might ask you to take off your boots when you walk in, because they don't want their house to get all muddy. So that's actually an interesting application, where even if we wear shoes, then maybe boots is more, what?
But they don't take off the boots.
Who doesn't dare?
If you have a big snow and you've got boots on, you're not going to take it off.
And Joel?
Yeah, you're going to walk in your stockings.
No, you bring a pair of shoes with you.
But they don't.
Maybe.
Do that.
Well, so that's the problem. That's a problem with this. But in theory, if it was possible, then what? Okay. So a similar question when it comes to spitting, right? So we said in the Gemara that it's okay to spit in Joel because people wouldn't be makpid on you spitting in their home. The Shaar HaTzion in source 19 says, well, you know, if especially wealthy people who would care if you spit in their on their nice floors, so we should tell them not to spit in the shul, because if you won't do it in your home, so you won't do it in the shul. Okay, so we see that some of this is a little bit objective. I'm going to skip to source 22. Okay, so the Raman notes that that we're supposed to put the bima, meaning like where we land, so that should be in the center of shul. Why should it be in the center of shul? Because that way everyone can hear the landing, right? If it's in the center, so everyone all around can hear it. If it's totally at the front, so only the people in the front can hear. So that's what most of Rishonim say. The Chasam Sofer has a little bit of a chiddush in source 23, that the reason why the bima has to be in the center is A, because we read about the korbanos on some occasions, so that's a mimicry of the Beis HaMikdash. So just like the Mizbeach was in the middle of the Azara, so too the Bima should be in the middle of the Shul. And same with the Hoshanos, right? We walk around the Bima when we do Hoshanos. So since that mimics walking around the Mizbeach with the Aravos, so that's why the Bima should be in the middle.
Don't we Dafka take out a Sefer Torah? So doesn't that symbolize the altar?
We don't walk around the Sefer Torah, do we?
No.
Like Sefer Torah. I don't know.
Sefer Torah, you walk around.
Yeah, right. But that has nothing to do with Beis HaMikdash. I don't think that's it.
They did it in the Beis HaMikdash.
Yeah. They walked around the Sefer Torah. They didn't do a kafas on the thing. What the rabbis they did.
No, in the synagogue.
Right.
They had a synagogue there. Uh-huh.
Okay, anyway, so Rav Moshe Feinstein pushes back on the Chasam Sofer's point a little bit, and says that, you know, it's a nice idea, but it's his idea, it's not really based on any sources that that a bima is compared with a mizbeach, and problems with there's conceptual problems with linking the bima to mizbeach. So Rav Moshe says that, you know, it should be in the middle, partially because so that people can hear. He's also concerned about the changes in non-Orthodox synagogues where it was put on the bima. So he says it shouldn't be directly in front of the Aron Kodesh. You should be able to do, you know, for example, on Shana Rabbah, you should be able to do the Akafos or Hashanahs in general. But the idea that's compared to Mizbeach, not so much, right? So you see the tension. The Chasam Sofer wants to take the Shul being a Mikdash Ma metaphor as far as to say that the Bima mimics the Mizbeach. Rav Moshe is not willing to go quite that far in making the comparison. So the Duchening thing, right? So taking off shoes during Duchening. So the Rabbi mentions that there were some who believed that. So when they did Birkas Kohanim Beis HaMikdash, so they would say the Shem Meforash, they would say the full divine name out loud. So there are apparently some people who thought that as long as the Shliach Tzibur does it quietly, you could do that outside the Beis HaMikdash as well, right? Because, you know, you want the Duchening to mimic the Beis HaMikdash, so that's really not appropriate. So the Raviyah pushes back against that, but he brings it. So that's another interesting application of comparing the Beis HaMikdash with the Shul. Again, a place where maybe we won't take the analogy quite as far. So another place where this potentially becomes very interesting is when it comes to women in Yidda, because there are a number of Ashkenazi Rishonim who note that women in Yidda didn't have the custom of coming to Shul, presumably because if the Shul is a Mikdash Me'at, so when you're in Tumah, so then you shouldn't come into Shul. So this was a widespread practice that many Rishonim endorsed. It sounds like that it actually started, it was a grassroots that started with women, but Rishonim seemed to agree with it.
My brother-in-law didn't let my sister leave.
Really? So at this point, it seems like it's fallen out of practice. But Rashi, in the Master of Victory, they note that Rashi believed that, on the one hand, it's really not based on anything, and in fact, it doesn't really work that way, right? Because you don't bring the proper korbanot after a woman comes out of Nida. So just the fact that she goes to the mikvah doesn't suffice. He says it's a nice practice, but there's really nothing to it. So Professor Jeffrey Wolf, what I brought at the end. So he notes that in general in Ashkenaz, they were very into Beis HaMikdash comparisons with their shul. He even brings a crazy story of somebody who performed human sacrifices in a shul, and the way he described these sacrifices, he was like as if he was trying to like do it in the Beis HaMikdash. But even not going that far, when it comes to like women in mikvah, for example, so this was a very Ashkenazi thing that they wanted their shuls to mimic the Beis HaMikdash.
She shouldn't. I don't understand. You tell me Beis anyway. You're not allowed to go.
Right. So that's what Rashi's saying. It doesn't make sense. But the extent to which we might treat a shul like a Beis HaMikdash, in some ways actually might have depended on the locale. So we noted that in some ways it just had to do with customs in terms of wearing shoes and the like. In other cases, it had to do with it was much broader, much conceptual than that. But to close, we don't have a Beis HaMikdash anymore, and our shuls in some ways definitely serve as a Mikdash Me'at. That's very much based in sources. So on the one hand, when we walk into shul on a daily basis, we might not see ourselves as being on the Beis HaMikdash, and there might be some pros to that, but there's also good opportunity for us to reflect about our behavior in shul, and that even if certain things that were allowed in Beis HaMikdash were not allowed in Beis HaMikdash are okay here, but we certainly should see to it that we treat our shuls with the proper kavod.